today is I just have slides, so I'm not going to do any like live coding. So hopefully that will be a change of pace. So yeah, I wanted to spend the next two lectures, I think, on a couple of methods that are both basically called Markov chain Monte Carlo. And I'll get into what that actually means and what it's for. And then we'll look at how to implement it in your code. It's a surprisingly simple algorithm that has some really interesting but also challenging promises. So it provides some like strong guarantees in the limit of infinite time. It's like strong guarantees for a case that you're not in. So it's kind of it's an interesting kind of method, and is very, very widely used in practice in science. And I'm borrowing these slides, or like many of these slides, from my colleague Dan Foreman-Mackey, because he has much better design sense than I do. He made a really nice set of slides, and I thought, I am not going to reinvent a worse wheel than Dan's slides. So we've been talking about this view of generative data modeling, where we were trying to fit a model, in our case, just a simple straight line model, to a set of data points. And we were taking this view that we could come up with like a model for the data. We were coming up with, when we were given an x position, we were making a prediction for what the y is. So we had a forward model for what we would observe. And then we actually had some data. And what we're trying to do is, conceptually, we're trying to turn it around, where we have some data and we're trying to use inference to say things about the model. So, we have a bunch of data points, and we were trying in the end to constrain those parameters for our model, like the m's and b's, like basically which m's and b's actually fit our data. So that's called inference. It's statistical inference. You're inferring things about what the model can be based on what you've observed. Okay. Hi, good to see everybody. I'll give everybody a minute to get set up. So basically, to recap, I'm talking today about Markov chain Monte Carlo. This really neat algorithm for doing inference in statistical models. What we've been talking about so far in model fitting, we've been doing likelihood functions. We've been thinking about likelihood or probability of data given model parameters. And now this gets to a bit of a, there's a bit of a rift in statistics between two camps called frequentists and Bayesians. And frequentists are happy with this world, and Bayesians say, no, we're not content with just listing off how likely we were to draw that data set given physics. We want to go all the way to saying, we want to give probabilities for physical parameters given our data. And the way to do that, or at least the way we'll do that today, is by folding in, basically, just to make the math work out, to make the integrals work out, you have to fold in this term called the posterior, or the prior probability, this P of physics. And this whole thing is called the posterior probability. And frequentists find this term so offensive that they say they won't even consider it. So this is like the base of the split. But if you want to be able to actually write down, like to draw conclusions about physics given data, you kind of have to be Bayesian in some views.
So exactly, physics, how just the P of physics is different from the data given physics?
Let me give you a simple example. P of physics might be something like, so that's called the prior, and it's basically like a probability over parameters in your model before you've seen any data. So it might be something as simple as, I know from just my knowledge of the world that like some parameter has to be positive, right? Like, so you could say, even though the, if I just write down the equations for the thing, then maybe this parameter could be negative or positive, but we know from physics or from intuition that it has to be positive. So that would be an example of a prior, and that would be a P of physics term that would come in. So these slides use physics, but it really just means like a model for the data that we observed. I sort of mentioned this example before. This is Perlmutter et al. In 1999, where they observed a set of supernovae, and they observed these stars that sort of, they explode, and then they brighten up to a point, and then they fade. And they measured the peak brightness of all of these supernovae, and then measured the redshifts to the galaxies that hosted them. And they observed this curve. So basically, they observed very nearby supernovae are bright, and as they get more distant, they fade off with this curve. And they came up with a generative model for their data, which is that the brightnesses we observed are these are in weird astronomer units of magnitudes, but so the magnitude you observed is some intrinsic magnitude. So the belief is that all of these things, all of these objects, these supernovae, are fundamentally the same. Like they're basically the same explosion repeated over and over again. Because of the way that the formation channel for them. So like basically all these explosions are thought to be the same intrinsic brightness. So there's some intrinsic magnitude. And then there's this thing called the luminosity distance, which just tells you how it fades with redshift. And that depends on a couple of other parameters about the contents of the universe. And if you plug in, basically different, and then so actually, yeah, so let me say, I guess, the generative model for a single data point is all of that, plus some noise for each data point. And their belief is that that noise is drawn according to a Gaussian. So for a number of reasons, but like basically it kind of makes sense from the way they do their data collection that it would end up being Gaussian. So each of these points has an error bar. And then, so given that, you can write down that second line that says, that gives you the likelihood. So this is the likelihood of drawing a single observation given parameters. And that's a Gaussian, as we sort of did in, as we did in class for the fitting a straight line. And then it, since it's, there's another strong assumption in there that all the data points are independent. So then the probability for the whole data set becomes this product of the individual ones. So the individual likelihoods. And I've done like a bunch of changing notation here, but luminosity distance becomes this DL in cosmology speak. And the parameters of the model end up being how much mass is in the universe and how much dark energy is in the universe. And basically, as you adjust those, as you adjust omega m and omega matter, that changes the exact like shape of that curve. So it might like, you know, make it curve down more or up more. And then the there's also this intrinsic magnitude that would shift the whole thing up or down.
I have a question.
Yeah.
It's about dark energy.
Yes.
It's like a physics question. I'm not a physicist myself, but I'm curious. When you're saying the mass of the whole dark energy in the universe, you're saying that we're plugging in the mass of the dark matter we know exists. Like assuming the universe is infinite.
Yeah, so the model is assuming like an infinite uniform, you know, fluid basically with with some amount of, you know, matter, dark matter and baryons, and dark energy. And that basically just determines the growth rate, like this, how quickly the universe expands. Like if you increase the amount of dark energy, then it starts to accelerate faster and faster.
Ah, I see. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, so basically this whole setup gives us kind of exactly the sort of problem that Markov chain Monte Carlo will allow us to solve. And that's the reason that people care about it, because this is a sort of problem that comes up a lot. Like, you know, this is a pretty kind of not unusual setup for an experimental result. Okay, so then this is like the part that some people find objectionable, but the Bayesians would proceed by saying, we want to, in the end, we want to make statements about the probabilities that there really are different amounts of matter and dark energy in the universe based on our data. And so that ends up still having the likelihood term just as before, and then it also has this prior term on omega m and omega lambda. And in practice, people, physicists in particular, usually like to use what are called flat priors or uninformative priors. So they'll try not to plug in too much information. You have to write down some probability distribution. So you have to write down something very concrete. But they try to write down something that is about as vague as you can, or like about as general as you can make it. That's actually even really difficult to do. But for example, for priors on omega m and omega lambda, you might say that they have to be positive, and they have to be like, maybe they're less than like some ridiculously large value, like less than 3 or something. So let me show you what that would look like. So if you, so this is sort of what happens if you have different amounts of omega m and omega lambda. There's if you have too much, then you can't have a big bang in the first place. So if you included this whole prior space, that would be very, very generous. You know, that basically like it contains all reasonable models. And then it allows even like a closed, flat, or open universe. So at that point, they run Markov chain Monte Carlo, and the results they get out are these basically ellipses. And those ellipses are basically what you write in your paper. Or like they're essentially the result of your data analysis. And the conclusion you draw from them are the results you talk about. So basically, one thing would be that they're if you, yeah, so one, it's, this is almost 25 years ago now, but so it's like people were still arguing, or there was some, still felt to be some possibility that this was what the universe was. So basically, their results kind of conclusively rule that out. And if you, and then also, Omega Lambda being zero is also a, like, sorry, Omega Lambda. Yeah, that was a possibility. So basically, like, it was quite a landmark result, like this. Well, landed them the Nobel Prize, coming up with those contours. Okay, so, sorry, there's a lot of text on these slides. But basically, yeah, so the need for Markov chain Monte Carlo kind of comes up all the time in these problems. Basically, because these forward models and likelihoods are often complex. So, so then basically to represent these probability distributions that can be complicated, we end up using, instead of being able to work them out mathematically, exactly what the contours are shaped like, it's often easier in practice, or the only way we can actually come up with is to draw samples out of the distributions and plot where the samples are, like plot what the shape of those contours are like. So yeah, this Markov chain Monte Carlo algorithm is used for drawing samples from a probability distribution that you can compute numerically, but you don't know, you can't sample from analytically. Let me show you, actually, this one is probably a better example. So this is just some, this is from, excuse me, there's another cosmology example that's looking at non-Gaussianity in the early universe conditions. So like there's the fluctuations are thought to be Gaussian, so but you can measure whether they are whether they have some non-Gaussian components. And you can see that these, like, the contours they come up with are these, like, weird, oddly shaped things where kind of nobody knows what that, what the actual equation for that probability distribution is. You can only sort of learn about it through sampling from it and saying how it consistent it is with your data sets. Okay, so this is like going back to Dan's slides. MCMC draws samples from a probability distribution, and all you have to be able to do is evaluate it up to a function, up to a constant. Okay, so the way this algorithm works is, so this is showing, this plot is showing some parameter space. Like, so imagine it's like the amount of, say, mass or matter and dark energy in the universe. And the contours are showing the probability of each of those contours according to your data set. So, like, basically, this would, the center of this contour would be the highest probability area. And then it sort of drops off away from that. And, in the MCMC algorithm, what you do is draw like start at some random place in that parameter space, and then it, we're, it's going to randomly jump around in that parameter space, and either accept those like sorry, shouldn't let it. I think there's actually a, okay, start here. It's going to propose jumping from that place to a new place in the parameter space. And then, And then it will call the probability function in that new place and decide whether to jump there or not. Now, there's an unfortunate typo in all of these slides, and I could not get Dan to fix them because he first gave this talk like 10 years ago and he's lost the original sources. So unfortunately, this part of this thing should be flipped upside down. And for all the things we're going to be looking at, the Q is going to be Gaussian. So we're going to make like a Gaussian proposal to jump to some new place in the parameter space. And for the Gaussian, the two Q's are equal. So just ignore those. So basically, we're going to jump to the new place if it's better, if it has higher likelihood. And then if it has worse likelihood, we'll jump there sometimes anyway. So it's a really, it's an odd little algorithm. So it's sort of like if you're looking for the peak, you move in a random direction. If it's uphill, you always go there. And if it's downhill, you sometimes go there, depending on how much downhill it is. If it's 1/10 as good, you go there 1/10 of the time. And it turns out that in the long term, this will correctly sample that distribution. It's a very, very weird result.
In long term, what?
So if you run this many, many times,
yeah,
it will correctly draw samples from that distribution.
Ah, yeah, I see. Yeah, it actually makes sense.
Yeah, so this is sort of like running the algorithm for a few times. Like those were all toward that main probability contour, so they were all uphill steps, all good steps. And then in this case, it's one that's moving away from that main contour, so it's worse. So that one doesn't get accepted. And yeah, there's a funny little side thing that if you draw a proposal to step away from a place and decide not to go there, you count again this place where you decided to stay. So like it counts that one, it double counts that one. And basically over time, the idea is that you start out at some terrible place and it pretty quickly finds the peak. And then essentially just like is supposed to walk along that ridge and kind of explore that probability contour. And if you run it for longer and longer, it will continue to, draw samples from this distribution, drawing more samples where the probability is higher and fewer where the probability is lower. And if you run it for longer and longer, you'll see it draw like more and more kind of further on the outskirts as it starts to explore further down. But basically still keeping most of the samples in the middle. And then over time, it kind of maps out this probability space. And that particular recipe for deciding whether to stay, like drawing a sample and then deciding whether to jump there or not, is called Metropolis Hastings. So in full, this thing would be called like Metropolis Hastings Markov chain Monte Carlo, which is like a mouthful.
The question is, previously I've heard about Markov chain, and I was introduced to an idea that you, let's say, has some area which you want to sample, and you randomly choose the place where to go, and like out of thousands, maybe like random samples, you're just figuring out in which area your desired area should be. I think this is somehow different between what we have here, and you're saying the difference is that we use this Metropolis Hastings to actually do meaningful examples.
Right. So actually, I think I have. I have a a slide that sort of unpacks the name a bit.
Uh-huh.
But there's basically the Monte Carlo part is funny. It's referencing a casino in Monaco. And that is basically just referring to the fact that you use randomness in the algorithm. And these things were worked out in in the 50s. So the idea of using randomness in a computer program was revolutionary.
Uh-huh.
Because they were like, why would you introduce noise, totally a random thing into a machine that we built to be deterministic and to perfectly compute things? And it turns out that sometimes. So sometimes people will talk about just a Monte Carlo algorithm to mean just a random algorithm. A nice example. I think if I write on this one, you can see it without us having to change the lights. There's a funny algorithm where if you draw two random numbers between 0 and 1, and then compute the sum of their squares, and if that's less than 1, then you keep it, and if it's greater than 1, you reject it.
Uh-huh.
So if you just Monte Carlo that thing, that means that you just draw totally independent random samples.
Yeah.
And if you, I guess I should do this. If you keep all these ones and mark and reject all those ones, then if you do that a bunch of times, then the number of X's over number of X's and O's is something, I think it's, what is it, pi over 4? So it's the worst way of computing pi.
<That's fine.
laughs> By random sampling and counting which ones have that property.
Okay, I see.
So yeah, that one, basically, because it doesn't have any, because all of the samples are independent, it doesn't really have any, state or any, it isn't very smart about sampling the space.
Right. It makes sense.
Yeah, so anyway, and then the Markov chain part is basically that fact that you're generating the samples in some reasonable way. It's old, so the terminology is weird. A chain here basically just means a list. So you'll, and this still persists, people will talk about using the Planck chains, and those are the samples, the probability samples produced by the Planck satellite team that represent their probability distribution. So that chain still persists as a bit of terminology. And it just means a list of samples. And the Markov part, or the Markov chain part basically means that each sample in that chain only depends on the previous sample, according to a decision process. And Markov is this 19th century Russian mathematician with a glorious mustache and a Wikipedia page that is just phenomenal.
Or better.
Pardon?
Like Nietzsche has the or better.
Oh, I don't know. Nietzsche versus Markov, that's a good good Russian math madness, March Madness, Russian mathematicians. And Metropolis, Hastings are two lead authors of papers that kind of worked out this algorithm. Okay, so very long name for the algorithm. Almost longer than the algorithm itself. So basically, here's a kind of a sketch of a of an MCMC for Metropolis Hastings function. So you have to pass in your probability function, a proposal function, that's one that says, I'm here, where should I jump to next? For us, that will be like a Gaussian. So we'll draw like, just draw a random number and jump according to that. And then some initial position and a number of steps that you want to run. And basically, the terminology is usually that you're moving a walker or a particle around this space. And you'll hear that, you'll hear both of those things used. So this walker starts at that initial position, and you compute the initial probability where you started out, and then you start with an empty chain. This is just, the chain is just going to be like a list of your results. And then basically for each step, we're going to propose a new place to jump in the parameter space. I haven't filled that in yet. Compute the probability at that new place, and then decide whether we're going to jump there or not. And then regardless of whether we jump there or not, we'll save the position where we decided to stay. And then at the end, we just return our chain. So I'll fill in those little bits. They won't be very surprising, I don't think. So jumping to a new place in the parameter space, we'll just be calling our proposal function. Computing the probability at the new place, we'll be calling this probability function with the new place. And then here's the deciding step. This can be written in a few different ways, but this is kind of the most compact way. We look at the probability at the new place versus, or divided by the probability at the old place, and compare that to a uniform random number. So if the probability, so that's a uniform random number between 0 and 1. So if the probability at the new place is bigger than the probability at the old place, you'll always jump there. It's always going to be greater than 1.
Wait, yeah. So like we compare our probability of new position with probability of old position to uniform random number?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, because if the probability at the new place is, say, 1/10 as much as the probability at the old place,
yeah, but
you want to jump there 1/10
of some random number. As I understood, this like uniform random number means it could be like less always, and we never go on a move anywhere, just because the randomness would be consistently lower.
Right. You draw a uniform random number every time through the loop. Like, so you draw a new one every time through. So if prob new over prob is say 0.1,
okay,
then most of the time, if you draw a uniform random number, most of the time it's going to be greater than that 0.1, and you won't decide to jump there. But then 10% of the time it will be less, the uniform random number will be less than that, and you will decide to jump there.
Okay.
You see, like that, so it, like, sorry, does that make sense? It's like,
yeah, more or less. I think it would make sense more when I would run it and see how it actually looks like, because it's hard to imagine.
Yeah.
What is the algorithm in general?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yep.
Yeah, but
no, exactly. Like that is a weird sort of way to write that, but it basically just means that if the new probability is like 10% of the old probability, you want to jump there anyway 10% of the time. And you can do that by drawing this random number and taking it if it's less than 10%.
Okay.
Yeah, so then basically if you decide to go there, you're the place you are, their position is this P nu, and your probability is probability nu, and then done. Okay, time, perfect. Okay, so so in practice, again, like we talked about, like we saw before, usually you want to work in log probabilities, just because otherwise the probability numbers tend to be really small. So it's usually, in practice, you want to use log probabilities. So the probability function becomes log prob. Everything else is more or less the same. Except for then this part becomes, instead of division, you're doing a subtraction, then an exp. So that's just kind of all exactly as you'd expect. And then the other thing is, one other kind of additional bit of handiness is, as I'll tell you in a bit, usually you want to count how often those jumps get accepted. And I'll show you why that is exactly, but just while we're talking about algorithms, usually you would keep some counter that says that, I've called it nAccept here, that counts how many times you accepted a move, and you'll want to like return it at the end.
Dustin?
Yeah.
Could you comment on the uniform random function that you have in the decision step?
Sure. Yeah, so what uniform random does, I think it, like, there isn't actually a Julia function named that, I just, but there must be, I think Julia's rand, I think, does that. So if you draw rand one, I think it does that. So basically, it just draws between 0 and 1. It draws some number uniformly in that range.
Mm-hmm.
So if you, you know, if you plotted, if you drew a million random ones and histogrammed them, it would just be like a totally flat distribution.
Yeah.
Where, like, Julia also has this rand n for normal. Whereas if you drew like 1,000 of those, you would get some Gaussian distribution around 0. Plus 1, minus 1, something like that. Whereas so if you draw like rand of 1,000 and histogram them, they're uniformly distributed between 0 and 1.
Makes sense.
And then basically, so to sort of say it again, if you, so let's say, you know, the probability contour is here, and your proposal jumps down to a place that is where the probability at P nu is like, say, 20%.
We decide this probability randomly. We don't have any like feedback from this like area we want to get into. Like, how do we know we hit the right place at the first?
Yeah, like how do you know what these contours are?
Yeah, so let's say we had the Keynesian position somewhere outside of this desired area, and we randomly sample. How do we know that we are far or close or into that?
Yeah, good. that's actually a difficult question in general.
Right.
So
because as far as I can see, we like randomly choose these. Are we close or not really? Because we choose like rand to 1,000 from 0 to 1. Do we go there or not? And if it just say no, we just stay in there and choosing another direction. So it happens completely random, am I correct?
Well, the thing that's not random, so maybe is this the probability function.
So this probability function basically gives us some information about do we go in the right direction or not.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Exactly. That's basically what defines what those contours are.
Uh-huh.
Like we don't. I plotted those contours, but like we don't ahead of time we don't know what those contours are.
So we have certain
and, like,
limited information about what is the area in which direction it's located, but we cannot use that probability function to basically not do like a random sampling and just build or hit the right spot at the first time. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, that's understandable.
And I guess I should have provided a little more context. When we were looking at our fitting a line example, we could do a few different things to explore that space. And one thing we could do when we were looking at like our MB example was we could just make a grid of those points and evaluate it at all the grid points, right? And we could like plot out the heat map or like basically draw out that contour. And in fact, like in that 2D example, we could do the same thing. You know, we could just lay down a grid and evaluate the function at each of those grid points.
Yeah.
And that would, and then we could, you know, plot what that looks like. The challenge is when your model starts to have 3 parameters, 4 parameters, 10 parameters, 20 parameters, then things are much harder and you can't really do that anymore.
Yeah, okay, now it makes sense.
Yeah, sorry, I always forget to give these bits of those contexts and reasons for these things. So there's some practicalities that proposal distribution and how many steps do I have to take before I'm done. So if we're in this example space again, and we're here, and if our proposal is like this, then many of these proposals are telling us, if you think of this as like a landscape, then we're sort of on the ridge of this mountain. And a lot of those proposals are to like jump off the sides, right? A lot of the area here is going into much worse parts of the parameter of the terrain. And it's only the ones that are along that ridge line that are kind of reasonable choices. So if the proposal distribution is big like that, then a lot of those are going to get rejected because a lot of them are proposals to jump to a much worse part of the parameter space. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, and I wanted to say here, if the probability at the new place over the probability at the old place is say 20%, then that means that you know, if you draw these, when you're drawing these random samples, you're only keeping the ones that are in here, right? Mm-hmm. If that's the way to kind of think about that. So basically, a lot of these jumps are going to get rejected. Like a lot of these proposed jumps will be rejected because they're jumping into places where it's, say, 1%. And that means that you're going to draw a random number in this range and only keep it if you draw a random number in that, like,
yeah,
that's less than that 1% part.
I started understanding this.
So what happens if you do that is that, and remember, every time you draw one of these samples and decide not to jump there, you keep an extra copy of this, that point in the chain. And so that means that very few of those jumps are actually getting kept. And that means that you don't move around that space very much. Like, the goal is to draw samples from all over that space. But if you're proposing big jumps, then only a small fraction of them get kept. And effectively, you don't move around the space very much. And then there's kind of the opposite problem. If you have a really tiny proposal, like take a little step, then the terrain doesn't change very much, and you are still fairly likely to accept even steps that are worse. The problem with that is it just takes if you take small steps, it takes an awful long time to get anywhere. Yeah. So it takes a long time to find the original peak, and then once you get there, it just takes a long time to explore very far. So you might spend a lot of time just sampling one little region where there's still a lot more to be found, just because all of the steps are very small. So that's kind of the opposite problem, where you're accepting almost all of the moves. Yep.
Is there a way to adapt the size of the jumps, like as you
go? Yeah, good. It turns out to be hard to implement in practice, because the thing I didn't tell you is that the reason for that rule, like the acceptance rule of like sometimes accepting bad steps and keeping the extra one when you don't take it, is that it's required to satisfy the theoretical guarantees of the algorithm. It's sort of like a thermodynamic kind of thing. It's called detailed balance in the algorithm. And if you adapt the step size dynamically, then it's hard to do that without breaking detailed balance. So it's hard to get the algorithm to still provide the same theoretical guarantee in the long run. So that would mean that it would like return some samples, but they wouldn't actually exactly map the parameter, the probability space correctly. They'd be mapping some other space. So you can sort of adapt it in, like you can do like test runs to figure it out in advance, and then freeze it, and then run your like real run. So yeah, you can like sort of cheat and do that. But having it do it like adaptively online is hard to implement in practice. This is sort of saying, this is kind of getting to your question. What if you could have a proposal distribution that was like aligned with the probability space? Then you'd be making reasonable proposals all the time. And indeed, that works way better. In a fancy Dan speak, his objection to that is that if you're sampling a 10-dimensional parameter space, then that's a lot of parameters that you have to set for that to describe that jump distribution. Okay, so you can sort of tell that I'm setting up to show you an alternative to this algorithm next time, as the dimensionality of your problem gets harder, it gets harder and harder to do this Metropolis Hastings because of this kind of tuning problem of like coming up with the proposals. But that will wait for next week, tomorrow, actually, tomorrow morning. Sorry, get confused. There's so many lectures and PSI courses. Okay, so this is sort of saying it again. In Metropolis Hastings, the proposal distribution has these tuning parameters of how big of jumps should I take. That's one way of looking at it, is that the algorithm is not invariant to an affine transformation of the parameters. Like it sort of cares about whether you're measuring in meters or light years, because you have to set these like jump sizes. And next lecture, we'll look at an alternative algorithm that does have affine invariance and achieves the same ultimate result of sampling from a probability distribution. Okay. The other question is, how many samples do I need to have a good sampling of this probability space? So in practice, what people do is there's this phase called burn-in, because, you know, remember we started from some like far out place, and then it eventually took a few steps to kind of find the main body of the distribution. And in practice, what people do is just ignore those first, you know, ignore the first 500 something, ignore the first 1,000 samples or something, because that up until that point, the algorithm hasn't really reached its like steady state. But then still, even once you've like hit the main, kind of hopefully the main body of the probability distribution, there's this question of, am I done yet? Like, has my chain, and people call this, has my chain converged? So basically, have I sampled the distribution correctly? And there's no really good answer for that, to be honest. And usually in practice, the answer is, how much computer time do I have? And if I look at the first half or second half of my results, do they look the same? Like, and other than that, there are some a little bit more quantitative guess, like ways of looking at it, but in the end, it comes down to basically experience or finding that the results are not really changing, looking at some diagnostics. Yeah, I'm not gonna actually go into that, sorry. I stole these slides from a different talk, so it was a little bit in more depth. But basically, yeah, you can, sorry, I guess. I spent just as much time saying I'm not gonna talk about it as I would have spent talking about it. This algorithm draws correlated samples, and you can measure how long that correlation time is. Like basically, how many samples is it between, do I have to take before these two samples are effectively uncorrelated? So that helps to, that's one way, one thing to measure to determine, to help to figure out whether a chain is converged. And then how many uncorrelated samples do I need? There's no really easy answer to that, to be honest. Okay, so that's basically all I wanted to tell you about this algorithm. It's, you know, this very, very old tool, and yet it still is used. It's, you know, the mainstay of inference. In cosmology, like, all of the major results are basically showing the results from Markov chain Monte Carlo and arguing about what those contours mean. And, you know, for science purposes, we can, you know, the setup is essentially that it lets us constrain model parameters based on data. And, you know, it's this really simple algorithm, but it has also these sort of difficult practicalities. And like the, it has, you know, this beautiful guarantee that if you draw an infinite number of samples, it will correctly sample that probability distribution. And that's not very reassuring when you're not at infinite time, because it doesn't really tell you anything about it, what it will do in finite time. So it's sometimes a little bit of cold comfort. And in the tutorial, which is tomorrow afternoon, we'll get you to write the algorithm and experiment with it a little bit. And try to learn, feel some of this joy and pain yourselves. Okay, thank you. Happy to take any more questions or comments or arguments.
Comment a bit more on the detailed balance of Monte Carlo methods.
Yeah, sure. So the idea basically is that
come. It's like,
I'm trying to think of how people explain it. Essentially, you want to set up a you want to have a set of samples so that if you took any of the samples, I'm forgetting the nice explanation for this. Basically, you want it to be that from one place in the probability terrain to another, the probability of jumping one way and jumping back are like the inverse of, are related to their relative probabilities. Like the probability of being in one place and proposing to jump to the next, and that inverse are in proportion to their probabilities. And that Metropolis Hastings recipe like satisfies that. But basically, if you start any kind of the changes you try to make to the algorithm, you usually break that detailed balance.
I see.
That wasn't a really good explanation for it. It has a lot of deep. It draws on a lot of deep things that I don't have the tips of my fingers right now. It's kind of real. I'm sorry.
I'll look it up.
Not good. Not good explanation. But yeah, detailed balance is really. Deep. Yeah. And it's. Yeah, you'll see it's kind of.
Maybe one more question. I've heard that we're gonna have like two projects or some like two homeworks we would need to submit during the like 5 weeks period.
Right.
When's gonna happen?
This is a very good question. I think that Eric and I still need to decide exactly when and where those are. Like which topics they're on.
I don't know what kind of a project it's supposed to be, but if it's like a programming like homework assignment, usually it takes like 2 weeks.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And
in 1 week, but it still should be some time to do that in 22nd, and the last lesson would be next month 10th, I guess.
Okay.
So
yes. So it should be very soon then.
Okay.
Yes, good. Thank you for that reminder that we need to get that going.
Yeah, I really like tutorials. I would do them till the end of the program, but I know two more tasks should be solved as well.
Right, exactly. And I think in previous years, the homeworks have been like kind of along the same, like kind of similar to how the tutorials have been this year, as in sort of like semi-guided exercises.
Okay. If it's semi-guided, then I'm fine.
Hopefully semi-guided. But maybe for the homework, I guess we'll just be like a little bit bigger scope and looking for a little bit more interpretation.